Okay. So it's the Parshas Vayakhel. We will focus on the beginning of this week's Parsha, actually. The context of where we are holding now in the story of the Chumash. At last week's Parsha, we learned of Moshe's descent from Har Sinai. He'd been up there for 40 days and 40 nights receiving the Torah. On his way back down, he of course discovers, as Hashem had told him, that the Jewish people had sinned with the golden calf, had made the image, and were dancing around it. Moshe breaks the luchos on the way down, smashes them to bits, prays for the Jewish people that they shouldn't be destroyed, goes back up to Har Sinai, first to pray for them, comes back down, and then goes back up again to receive the second set of luchos. And he comes... and then eventually comes back down with the second set. The Torah describes the Keren Or Panav, how his face radiated with light, and is the spiritual plane in which he was at, that the people couldn't even bear to see him because of the level of holiness that he was exuding. He would wear a mask, and that's basically where the story ended at last week's parsha. This week we're going to open up with the actual words that Moshe now begins to teach the Jewish people upon his descent. And we'll learn one or two psukim, maybe three, and then we'll go back over them just to see what it is that we can get. So to get the context, let's learn the first couple of psukim. Vayakhel Moshe es kol adas b'nei Yisrael. Moshe assembled the entire assembly of the children of Israel. He gathered together all of the Jewish people. Vayomer aleihem eile hadvarim asher tzivo Hashem la'asos osam. And he says to them, these are the things that Hashem commanded to do them. So he gathers the people, he's now backed out from Har Sinai, and he gathers up all the people, and he says, these are the things that Hashem has commanded me regarding that which needs to be done. Sheishes yamim te'asen melacha, uvayoyim hashvi'i yihyeh lachem kodesh. 6 days you may do work, but on the seventh day, on the yom hashvi'i, that should be for you a day of holiness. Shabbos shabboson la Hashem, it is a complete rest for Hashem. Kol ha'isevo melacha, you must. Anyone who does work shall be put to death. So we have here the first thing that out of his mouth is the concept of Shabbos. Moshe comes down, he gathers up all of the people, he says to them, let me tell you the things that Hashem has told me. And he starts with Shabbos. For 6 days you may work, the seventh day is a day of rest, it's a day of holiness, and he mentions the punishment, the severity of Shabbos, that anyone who does work on the Shabbos, most you must, shall be put to death. Then he adds a detail of Shabbos. You shall not kindle any fire in any of your dwellings on the Shabbos day. So he adds a aspect, a detail of Shabbos. One is not permitted to light fire. Let's just read one or two more psukim just to get the context and go back. Then Hashem said to the entire assembly of the children of Israel. So right away, what do you say to yourself? Right here, I said, right, isn't he in the middle of speaking?
Yeah.
Right, and he started. He gathered all the people by Akel Moshe, called Das B'nai Yisrael, and he said to them, these are the things that Hashem commanded me, and he told them about
Shabbos.
Two psukim on Shabbos, one about the 6 days you can work, the seventh day is a day of rest, and he speaks about the severity of Shabbos, and he gives a halacha, you know how to light a fire. And then he starts again, he's still talking to everybody, he says again, and Moshe said to all the assembly of the Jewish people, this is the word that Hashem has commanded me, saying, take for you a portion for Hashem. Everyone whose heart motivates him shall take silver. Just read it in English quickly. Silver, gold, copper, turquoise, the purple, all the different skins and goat hair and stones and incense. And then for the entire rest of the parsha is a description of what they will do with them. What is it that we're going to do with all of these materials? We're going to construct a tabernacle. This is a repeat, almost word for word, of Parshas Truma. Parshas Truma about 3 weeks ago, in which Moshe is on Har Sinai, and Hashem says to Moshe, this is what I want you to do, gather from the Jewish people materials and make me a Mishkan. And he describes in the Parsha what the Mishkan will look like. This Parsha is a repetition of that, in which Moshe is now speaking to the Jewish people, saying what was said back in Parshas Truma, take from yourselves a portion, these are the materials that you need to donate, and this is what we're going to do with them. And then the Torah describes that they did it. And then the entirety of Parshas Vayakel, and then the next Parshas Pekudei, goes through that they donated the materials, they constructed the tabernacle, that's Parshas Vayakel. The next week, and Parshas Pekudei, the next Parsha, discusses the vestments, the clothing of the Kohen Gadol, which was also earlier stated when Moshe was on Har Sinai, where Hashem said to him what needed to be done. And here is actually where it is carried out. The materials are donated, and then the craftsmen and the artisans actually fashion the materials into the garments for the Kohen Gadol, and in this week's Parsha, into the actual vessels of the Mishkan. That's what takes place here. So as an overview, that's just the first couple of psukim. So far, so good.
Yeah.
Alright, so what are some of the issues that we're going to have to address? Before I throw out a couple, any comments, auras, questions?
Well, in the Hebrew, there's a vav.
Where?
In front of Moshe. So, and he said, in other words, the ad.
In which vav are you referring to? The very first word, Vayakel?
No,
in Dalet.
In Dalet. And Moshe said the entire time. Okay, in other words.
But the and wasn't in the English.
The English missed the and. Okay, write a letter to the editor.
Very observant.
Well, I wasn't correcting English. What I meant was, like we would say, he said this and this and this.
And he said something else. Okay, so it seems like he clearly is saying two things. What do you suppose is the bulk, when Moshe, when Parsha opens, Moshe gathers together the entire assemblage of the Jewish people, and he says to them, these are the things that Hashem has spoken to me. What is he referring to?
The oral law.
The commandments.
Okay, now he's not going to teach them everything right here.
No.
He's not going to teach them the entirety of the Torah in this gathering.
Mm-hmm.
What is he going to teach about in this gathering?
Well, the main thing is the Mishkan.
That's correct.
But Shabbos comes first.
So the main thing is going to be the Mishkan. That's what the entirety of these... It's going to be two long parshas basically describing what Moshe said to them. These are the materials that we need and this is what we're going to do. So this particular assembly, notice he doesn't teach them everything in this assembly. It's going to take them 40 years to teach them the entirety of the Torah. This assembly is primarily about teaching them about the Mishkan. It's about telling them what they need to donate and how we're going to make it, and then going about and doing it. And what we can't help but notice is that he precedes that with a statement about Shabbos. Now this is not the first time the Jewish people have heard about Shabbos. There are various references until this point already about Shabbos, and Moshe felt it necessary here again to do that. So we'll talk about that as well. Now the other thing of note is the Vayakel Moshe, that Moshe gathers them all together. We don't normally find, most of the time, what's the phrase that introduces most of the mitzvahs of the Torah? When Hashem wants to teach something through Moshe, how does the Torah introduce it? With what phrase?
Vayidaber.
Correct. Vayidaber Hashem. El Moshe Lemor. And Hashem spoke to Moshe saying, go speak to the Jewish people, which he does. And here you have an interesting thing where Moshe goes and gathers everybody. He gathers the entirety. Kol Adas B'nai Yisrael. Men, women, and children are all included in this particular gathering. So there's clearly something about the Mishkan which requires everyone to be doing it. And Moshe has to gather them together. And the other question which we'll address is, when exactly is this taking place? What is the chronology? When is this gathering happening? Alright, so let's learn a bit. Let's learn a little bit. First thing I just want to point out is Kol Adas B'nai Yisrael. So two comments that the Mefarshim, the commentators make on the fact that Moshe had to gather everybody together. First is from the Ramban. And the Ramban makes note of the fact that since everybody needed to be involved in the construction of the tabernacle, the Mishkan had to belong to the Jewish people. In order for it to be Hashem's home, and in order for it to be a central point of the Jewish people, where God's presence is manifest and recognized, and everybody can come, it has to belong to everybody. Can't be that Moshe called an executive meeting, and you know the top 20% of his movers and shakers gathered together, and said, we need to build a Mishkan. And they said, we'll do it, Moshe. And they went out and they took care of it.
Not a board meeting.
Right? It's not a board meeting because then it wouldn't be the Jewish peoples. Then it would be those peoples. And this had to belong to everybody. So the Ramban says, because everybody was going to contribute. And everybody, remember I gave a sermon, maybe it was 2 or 3 weeks ago, that there's a unique aspect of the Mishkan that generally when we do a capital campaign, what do I really want from you when I knock on your door for a capital campaign?
As much as you can get out of it.
Right, but what do I want out of you?
Money.
I want your money. What am I going to do with your money? I'm going to buy whatever I need to buy. And whether I need to buy construction materials, whether I need to pay a contractor, whether or not to be, I need to buy glasses or silverware. If I'm doing a capital campaign for Heritage Hall, the example that I used, I need your money to buy whatever I need. The Mishkan wasn't like that. They didn't contribute money. They actually contributed the materials that were going to be used. I gave you the gold that was going to be fashioned into the menorah. I gave you the turquoise wool that I was planning on using for my sweater. And I said, you know what, here, you'll take it and you'll make it into whatever you have. I had skins which I was planning on using as a cover for my tent, and I said, no, I'll give it to the Mishkan. The actual materials were given, and then from those materials, we fashioned the actual Mishkan. It's a very different kind of campaign. It's as if I went into your house and I said, okay, I need some flatware. How much can you give me? And you'd open up your cupboard, and you'd hand me two place settings and say, I used to serve and host 12. I'll now only host 10. I want to give it into the Beis HaMikdash. You'd open up your cupboard and you'd say, I need some oil. Well, they needed oil. They actually gave you my oil. I gave you my incense. I was going to use it for myself, and I gave it to the Mishkan. When you do that, it became the Jewish people's home. This was, we built Hashem's home. We built it with our own materials, and everybody had to be present as we heard about it. Everybody had to be present because everybody had to give and contribute to it. And so, that's one of the bond points. That's why here specifically Moshe needed to gather everybody together. The Kliyaka, one of the commentators that's printed in the standard edition of the Chumash, points out that there's another reason why Moshe needed to go out and gather them is because they didn't want to come. They were still frightened of Moshe. When Moshe came back down from Arsinai the second time, his face was glowing. Keren or Panav, he needed to wear a mask. And the Torah describes how if he wasn't covered, if his face wasn't covered, the people couldn't tolerate it. He had to go put his tent farther away. He would cover himself. People weren't interested. They were scared of him. And Moshe needed to go out and literally gather them all together to hear what he had to say. Okay. Vayakel Moshe, let's on the first Rashi.
Where did they have all these materials?
Excellent question.
I mean, they didn't have a Home Depot.
No, they didn't have a Home Depot. They just got out of Mitzrayim. They're wandering through the desert. I don't know exactly. I really don't. I don't know if they took them with them out of Mitzrayim. Chazal asked that question, but they only asked that question on the wood. There are Atzei Shittim. There were certain woods, pieces of wood that they used. And the sages ask, where did they get wood from in the desert? And the sages have this whole long thing that Yaakov told his children when going down to Mitzrayim that they were going to need it, so they planted the trees that they would have on the way back up. I don't know why the sages were only bothered by the wood. It seems like all the other material, they must have gotten from Mitzrayim. Because they asked that question, but they only are bothered by the wood. So apparently it wasn't something that was inconceivable that they should have the other wools and the skins and the dyes and the color and the copper and the gold. I don't know where it came from. I'm assuming Mitzrayim. But I don't know. Mm-hmm. Says Rashi, when is this happening? When is this Vayakel Moshe taking place? Rashi says, Lemocharos Yom HaKippurim. This is on the day after Yom Kippur. What's so significant about Yom Kippur, the first Yom Kippur in the desert?
That's when he came down the second time.
Exactly. That's when Moshe came down the second time. Second time meaning, what was the symbolism that the Jewish people received when Moshe came back down with the Luchos the second time? They had forgiven them. Exactly. The first Yom Kippur in history is the paramount paradigm of forgiveness for the Jewish people. We had a point in which we had sinned. Hashem had said, I want to destroy you. I'm going to start over with Moshe. Moshe intercedes on our behalf. And the biggest symbol that Hashem had forgiven us and had enacted a new covenant with us and had said that I will still be with you is the fact that on Yom Kippur, Moshe came back down after 40 days with the second set of Luchos. You'll remember this on Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is not just a day of atonement. Yom Kippur is a day of Kabbalah HaTorah. It's a day of the receiving of the Torah. Yom Kippur was the day that Moshe came down with the Luchos. It's the day that he came down and started teaching the Jewish people the second time. He never really got started the first time. He broke the Luchos before he came down. He came down and began teaching on Yom Kippur when we received the Luchos that we actually use. And you could tuck this question away for a further discussion, why it is that we celebrate Shavuos, the giving of the Torah, when we do, which is when the Torah was first given, which we never got. Because we never learned that Torah. That Torah, Moshe broke the Luchos and went back up to relearn everything, came down. Shavuos is towards the end of this, right, beginning of the summer. Pesach is in April, May. Shavuos is in June. He comes back down. He never taught us that Torah. He broke the Luchos, goes back up and comes back down. He goes back up 40 days to Daven, 40 days again, and he comes down Yom Kippur a couple months later. with the second luchos, and that's the Torah that he actually then teaches us. And there's a lot of discussion in the sages, the difference between the first set of luchos and the second set of luchos. But we celebrate Shavuos on the giving of the first set of luchos before, and then not on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, but Yom Kippur is also a day that we actually receive the second luchos, and Moshe comes down and begins teaching us Torah. You'll pocket that question, and we'll have to discuss it sometime. In any case, the Rashi says, when is this taking place? When Moshe comes down from Har Sinai, he comes down and he gathers up the Jewish people, and what's the first thing he's about to tell them? About the construction of the Mishkan. The first thing that Moshe does on his way back down is, says Rashi, the following day he gathers up the people to teach him about the Mishkan. Why should this be the first thing that he should teach them? Why should this be the first thing that he wants to go about? So the Ramban says what we would intuit on our own. What's the symbolism of the Mishkan?
Hashem
is going to put his presence back amongst the Jewish people. So the Ramban writes, now, parenthetically, the Ramban has a major dispute with Rashi as to whether or not the Mishkan was always supposed to have been there or whether or not it was a response to the Chet of the Ego. According to, it's really not for now, today's discussion. The Ramban holds that the commandment of the Mishkan, chronologically in the Torah, the way, not chronologically, but literally, when you read through the Torah, first we read about the commandment to build the Mishkan, then we read about the Chet HaEgel, the sin of the golden calf, and then how Moshe begs for forgiveness and gets the forgiveness, and then we read about this parsha where we actually build the Mishkan. So in Ramban holds, that's the order that it really happened in. We were given the command, at least Moshe was, he hadn't come back down yet, but Moshe was given the command to build the Mishkan. Then the Jews fell and sinned. Moshe pleads for their forgiveness, receives it, goes back up to get the Torah a second time. And when he comes back down, what's the first thing that he tells them to do? Build that Mishkan that I had been commanded to do before this whole detour that we took because you sinned with the golden calf and I had to go back up. Go build it. What's the first, why, says the Ramban, is that the first thing that Moshe feels it necessary to do when he comes back down? So the Ramban says, for the reason which we would have thought, Kikevan Shinisrat Lem HaKadosh Baruch Hu, once Hashem was appeased and happy again, pleased with his Jewish people, V'nosat Lo HaLuchos Shnios, he gave them the second set of Luchos, Koros Vimo Bris Chadoshi, sealed a second covenant with them that he would, Sheyelech Hashem Bekirbom, that he would travel in their midst, because at first he said, I'm not going with you anymore, I'm going to destroy you. And now Hashem agreed and he said, okay, I'll give you the Luchos and I will put my Shechina back in their midst. I will let them build a Mishkan and I will dwell there. Chazru l'kadmusam ula ahavas klulosam. The Jewish people returned to their previous stage. Uli ahavas klulosam. Now that phrase is a takeoff from a pasuk in Tanakh. Lech teich acharai b'midbar. When the Jewish people, like a kala following her chasam, like a bride following her groom, the Jewish people followed Hashem into the desert, and there was a loving relationship between the Jewish people and Hashem, and we ruined it. We were unfaithful. Says the Ramban, when Moshe comes back down after the second set of 40 days with the second set of luchos, chazru l'kadmusim, the language that he uses, the takeoff of the language of the kala, which we use in Tanakh, that that they returned to their previous state, uli ahavos kululusam, and to the love they had during that youthful time that they had, which is really only a couple of weeks before, but they had returned to that stage. So therefore, what do you do? Uviyadua shetia shechina sol v'socham, and that they know that they're going to have the shechina in their midst. Again, the presence will dwell in their midst. And therefore, just as he had said, va'asuli mikdash v'shachanti v'socham, as he initially had said, build for me a temple, a tabernacle, and I will dwell in their midst. V'lochein tivo samosha ata v'chol mashin instava v'nog. That's the first thing he says is, I'm back. I've been successful. You've been forgiven. Our relationship has been repaired. Go build that Mishkan that you were supposed to have built way before, but you messed up, but we can continue that process. So the first thing, says the Ramban, that's why the end of Sefer Shmos concludes with the building of the Mishkan. Moshe comes back down from Har Sinai, and the first thing that he says to them is, we got to build the Beis HaMikdash. So why is it on the day after Yom Kippur that this takes place? Says the Ramban, because that's the first thing you got to do. When you come back down, you got to build a Mishkan. You got to show that love between Hashem and the Jewish people. Parenthetically speaking, the Vilna Gaon writes that that's why Sukkot is right after Yom Kippur. Because since we started building the Mishkan right after Yom Kippur, so Yom Kippur is on the 10th day of the month of Tishrei, On the 11th day of Tishrei, Moshe teaches them and says, give me all your materials. On the 13th, on the 12th, 13th, and 14th, they gathered all of the materials. And on the 15th, they started building. And when they started building, the Shekhinah came back down, and that's the sukkah that we have. And the sukkah is representative of the Shekhinah returning to the Jewish people, represented by the Mishkan, and the Vilna Gaon says that's why Sukkot is right after Yom Kippur, because of what's taking place. They gather all the stuff. The Torah says they gather for a couple of days, and then Moshe says, we have enough. When they started to build, the Shekhinah returns, and that's the Sukkah that we sit in, which is the clouds of glory that return to the Jewish people, representative of the Shekhinah. That's why that's also Sukkot time. That's a whole long shmooze, which we could do Sukkot time, which I just gave you 2 seconds, just as a little teaser. One last point on this. This is the Kliyaker, one other commentary. Now again, what we just said is why this is happening on Yom Kippur. Rashi tells us that this gathering is taking place on Yom Kippur. The Ramban explains, as Rashi means as well, because this is the time that the Moshe just came down, and he wants to build the Tabernacle. He wants to build the Mishkan to show that Hashem's presence is back amongst the Jewish people. The Kliyaker makes the comment, which I don't know if he means it as the simple meaning of the text, but it's a poignant point that he makes, a sad testimony to the reality of the Jewish people, which I sort of throw in parenthetically to what's going on over here. He writes as follows. Moshe had to gather all the Jewish people together. We have to be one, we have to be unified, we have to be ba'aguda achas, as one group, because building of the Mishkan required that we be together in order to be able to construct that successfully. Well, in order for the Jewish people to do that, we have to actually feel like we're together. We have to be ba'achdos. So the Kliyaker says, when was the only time that Moshe was going to be able to do that? He needed to do that right after Yom Kippur, after the day of Yom Kippur. And he writes this language. It's, to me, it's a very sad statement, but it's a truism, unfortunately. He says, Mikol Makom. I'm sorry, here it is. It was easy to gather them all together right after Yom Kippur. Because the shalom, the peace, the feeling in a shul on Kol Nidre, Ni'ila. You're done, you've been together with everybody in the congregation for a whole long day, and you're sitting there screaming, Hashem, Hu Elokim, Shema Yisrael, Hashem. If there's any moment in a Jewish community where the community is as close as it ever will be, there's no question it's Ni'ila of Yom Kippur. Says the Kliyaker, it was easy for Moshe to go out the following morning and gather them all together, and everyone can still, with the memories lingering of Yom Kippur from the previous day, it could be. Avalim yom o yomayim ya'amo, but if you would have waited a day or 2 days, yukam hashalom, that peace, that unity, that achdus, already would be gone. Ki kfar nifrada hachavila, the rope has unwound or untangled. Everyone goes his own way. Not that there is necessarily antagonism, it's just that peace needs to be made. You have to make peace. And if not, everyone just goes, they do their own thing. So says the Kliyaker, it had to be right away after Yom Kippur, because in order for Moshe to be successful and get everybody together in the type of place and the mindset that they needed to build that together, a Mishkan, you have to like reach into the Yom Kippur experience and right away make use of it, and right away have everybody together. If even 2-3 days go by Sukkot already, when you come into Shul Sukkot time, it's like Yom Kippur was months ago. There's nothing left of the feeling that you had in Shul of Yom Kippur. It's just 5 days later. It's a new Yontiv. Sukkahs are up. Everyone has a lulav in the restaurant. Different families. And it's as if that experience never happened, unfortunately. But that's the reality. So Moshe says the Kliyaker, he grabbed them right away. The next morning, he had them all together while it was still fresh before he went. That's what we're fighting. It's worth noting that little comment, because as a Jewish people, that's what we're fighting. That constant just, you know, each man going his own way, doing their own thing, and it's so hard to create that feeling. Okay, so Moshe gathers together, it's called Das B'nai Yisrael, he gathers everybody, men, women, and children, because everybody has to contribute, and he says to them, these are the things that Hashem said, and then he goes into Shabbos. Before he gets into the idea of the Mishkan, which is really what his goal is, he gets into Shabbos, and he has 2 psukim on Shabbos. Says Rashi, Pasuk Beis Sheshes Yomim Hiktim Lohem Azharas Shabbos. He preceded the halachas of Shabbos to what he really wanted to teach, which is the halachas of the Mishkan. Lomar she'enu doicha es ha'shabbos. And what's this to teach, says Rashi? To teach that the construction of the Mishkan does not take precedence over Shabbos. You build the Mishkan, you start it on a Sunday, Friday afternoon, the construction of the Mishkan stops. Shabbos is coming. I might have thought, says Moshe, basically to the Jewish people, that the Mishkan was of such great importance, the home, the house of Hashem, that it should even take precedence over Shabbos. Says Moshe, no, before I teach you the laws of the Mishkan, I'm going to teach you the laws of Shabbos, to teach you that the Shabbos takes precedence and the construction of the Mishkan must stop on Shabbos. Now, this is where we learn, by the way, what the 39 malachas of Shabbos are. This is where the sages see. If you want to know what the Torah says, almost nothing about what you can and can't do on Shabbos. But from here, if the sages derived, if Moshe said, you're not allowed to build the Mishkan on Shabbos, then obviously whatever it took to build the Mishkan is what is prohibited on Shabbos. Because that's what the halacha is. Don't build the tree on Shabbos. Whatever you would have otherwise done to build the Mishkan becomes usher on Shabbos. And it's from here that the sages derive. They went through all the activities that took place in the Mishkan, and whatever principal activity was necessary to build the Mishkan, that is what's not allowed on Shabbos, because Moshe clearly said, don't do it on Shabbos, and that from there we derive the principal categories of forbidden activity on Shabbos. That's where it comes from this this source over here. That's how the sages derive it. Why can't you build a Mishkan on Shabbos? Why should it be? Shouldn't Hashem's house take precedence?
It's work.
So there's a lot to be said, but I just want to share one quick idea. What's the concept of the Mishkan? What is the Mishkan really represent?
God's house.
It's Hashem's house, exactly as he said. It's the presence, the seat of his Shechina, of his divine presence in this world. When you have a Mishkan, I think I've mentioned this many times in the past, it's worth saying over and over again, you find in Tanakh, which is up to the first temple period, you find all sorts of sins and shortfalls and calamities that the Jewish people do and befall them. There's one shortfall, one sin that you never find. You don't find anyone deny the presence of God. Today's world, that's all over the place. People, they question, they doubt, they don't think, because we don't see him. In the times of the temple, there's no such thing. Because there he was, come. Let's go to Yerushalayim, we'll go there. You'll see him, you actually perceive the presence of God, something which we can't wrap our minds around. 2,000 years of historical exile have ingrained, we don't know what that is. But in the first Beis HaMikdash, you saw the presence of Hashem. You went to the Mishkan, there was a cloud of glory. You perceived the divine. So it's a entrance into this world of the divine presence through the institution, through the Mishkan. It was a central place where you can go, you could connect, you would experience Hashem in a way that none of us have come close to since the destruction of the temple. The first time, even the second temple didn't have it the way they had it in the first temple. What's Shabbos? So Shabbos, we treat Shabbos, I'm going to condense Shalosh Shudas time we've been speaking about Shabbos, I'm going to condense an entire book into a short little shmooze. We speak about Shabbos, the sages speak about Shabbos as a personality in a way that we don't about any other mitzvah. Some examples. Kabbalah Shabbos. What's Kabbalah Shabbos? And what does it mean, Kabbalah? We greet the Shabbos. We have a whole special service on Friday night to greet the Shabbos queen. So, L'chadodi, Bowie, Kala, we come in. What do we do we turn around and we actually welcome in the Shabbos queen. What do we do on Motzei Shabbos? There's a Malava Malka. There's a concept in Judaism, we have a Malava Malka, which means we escort the queen. There's a personality that's involved when we talk about Shabbos that we don't really find elsewhere. There's a concept of cleaning the home on Shabbos, preparing for your Shabbos queen. It's part of the religious, spiritual culture of Shabbos that there is a presence coming to the world. We don't have that in any other concept. There's no other mitzvah. We don't greet Pesach. Pesach isn't a personality that speaks. Shabbos in the sages has a personality that talks. Shabbos complains. It says to God, every day of the week has a partner. Day one has day two, and day three has day four, and day five has day six. I'm all alone. And Hashem says, don't worry, Shabbos, you have the Jewish people. Pesach doesn't talk. Pesach doesn't complain. Shavuos doesn't have a personality. Sukkos isn't lonely. Shabbos has a personality. And what Shabbos really is the entering into the world of Hashem's presence into this world, in which we perceive it in a way. If everything comes to a standstill, and Hashem's presence is here. The example that I would use, which I think I've said here before, but as I say every week and all the time, it's worth repeating certain things. Let's say you have an air conditioner on in the background of your house or apartment or whatever, and there's a constant hum of the air conditioner. But as your day goes on, you have no idea that it's there, because during the day, there's just way too much activity going on in the house to notice the hum of the air conditioner between your own conversations and the phone's ringing and the television's on or the radio or you're cooking and the people about and their kids and there's noise outside and the cars on the street. All of a sudden, you lay down at night to go to sleep and you start hearing noises all over the place in the house. You hear the creaks, you hear the cracks, and you hear the air conditioner on. Like, where did that come from? Well, it was really there all the time, but what? You can't hear because there's way too many distractions to be able to hear something like that, even though it's there the whole time in the background. So the Mefarshim explain the concept of Shabbos. On Shabbos, we stop. It literally means to stop, to rest, to cease. There are many distractions in the world that don't allow us to see the backdrop of what's going on in the world because we're distracted by all the other noise. But what you do is if you stop the noise for a moment, if you can cut out all the other things that are distracting you, you will see that what's been there the whole time has been this constant hum of a background noise which you couldn't perceive with all else that's going on. So on Shabbos, in which we stop creative activity, there's no... So we're talking in a spiritual sense, not just making noise and banging on the table. But in the spiritual sense, when we're creating, we're building, we're doing activities that we are not permitted to do on Shabbos. They're all distractions. It's man's putting himself forward in the world, doing what Hashem wanted us to do. Fill the world, conquer it, develop it, build it, do things. But while we're doing things, we're making a lot of spiritual noise as well. And it's hard to perceive that which is in the background, that constant hum of the air conditioner when all the noise is going on. And on Shabbos, when the noise is cut out, and the creative work and activity stops, you have an ability, if you'll listen, it's really hard to hear it during the day. You can if you really try hard. Really hard during the day. But at night, when it's quiet, it's there on its own. Like your constant phone ringing. And on Shabbos, when the creative activity stops, then it's much easier to perceive the presence of Hashem. And what Shabbos does is it's that day that brings in Hashem's presence into the world in a way that you can perceive it, and we speak about it like a personality. We're welcoming Hashem into our world in a way that he's much more perceptible in the world than he was prior. Because all that noise is cut out, and we can see him. And we greet her, we send her home, we walk home from shul, we sing Zemiros about Shabbos, just about Shabbos, right? Have you ever sing any Zemiros, you know, about Pesach? Just the day, Pesach, Pesach, Pesach. We don't do that. But we just sing about Shabbos. And it's the bringing in of Hashem's presence. So the question I'm explaining, there is no Mishkan. You're not allowed to build a Mishkan on Shabbos. Because on Shabbos, that which we're trying to create through the Mishkan, we're trying to create a presence of Hashem which you could point to and say, there it is. We actually have all day on Shabbos everywhere. That's what we're doing. So you can't destroy that background noise. You can't do all that creative activity on Shabbos to build him a Mishkan when the concept, the presence of Hashem on Shabbos is in itself already there for the taking. So there's no construction of the Mishkan on Shabbos. It's the day of Hashem that's already there. Okay, let's do another pasuk. Let us do another pasuk. Lo sevarueish. So the third pasuk is another halacha in Shabbos. Lo sevarueish b'chol moshmoseichem v'yom hashavu. You're not allowed to light a fire. What's odd about this pasuk? What question would you have to ask?
There are a lot of things.
I
don't
know
why.
Excellent. This is the only thing mentioned in the entire Torah that's prohibited on Shabbos. Not to light a fire. Everything else is derived from what we mentioned a moment ago, that because the Torah says, don't build my tabernacle on Shabbos, so the sages said, okay, well, whatever it would have taken to build the tabernacle is obviously what we're not allowed to do on Shabbos. And we derived all 39, including fire, and this one is mentioned. You're not allowed to light a fire on Shabbos. Now, why it's there is a topic of much discussion. It's a discussion within the on the level of the Gemara and the sages and then the Farshim Ramban and others talk about it. There's one point that I want to bring out just to mention. What the Gemara talks about is what's the significance of it. Some of the sages learn that the significance is that that fire is actually more lenient than everything else. What's the punishment for every other violation of Shabbos?
Put to death.
Yeah. From the previous pasuk, it says you're put to death. The fact that the Torah pulls out one law must mean that it's somehow more lenient and it's less severe than everything else. We don't hold it, we go the other way. Another one of the sages says, you know why it's pulled out? To tell you, you don't have to violate every single principle of Shabbos to be put to death. I might have thought, the Torah says, if you violate Shabbos, punishment is, how do you violate Shabbos? Well, there are 39 things you have to do to violate Shabbos. Until you've done them all, you haven't really violated Shabbos. So the Torah pulls out one and says, don't light a fire. And the significance of what we learn from that is, you only need to do one. Just doing one is already considered a violation of Shabbos. You don't have to violate it all until you're considered in being in violation, which one might have thought, since this is what Shabbos is, until I've done all of that, I'm not yet in trouble. So the Torah pulls out one to say, no, even one is already considered, and whichever one it will be, is sufficient grounds for the death penalty. That's what the Gemara does with this. The Ramban has another couple of comments. He says, what's the significance of why is fire pulled out? He says, number one, it's to tell you that you're not allowed to cook on Shabbos. All the other Yom Tovim, with the exception of Yom Kippur, where you can't eat, you're allowed to actually use fire on Shabbos. So the Ramban comments that the reason why the Torah is stressing this particular activity of not lighting a fire is to teach you that you can't use fire for that kind of purpose. There's a Gemara somewhere that also derives that you're not allowed to... One of the four types of death penalties is skila, stoning. One is sreifa, is burning with molten lead, and or beheading, or strangulation. So, this religion is not for the weak of heart. So the Gemara learns from here, lo sevaru eish b'chol moshvosechem, you're not allowed to carry out a death sentence on Shabbos either. That the fire that you're not allowed to have, also even on Shabbos, you're not allowed to do that. Alright, various things. What I want to point out is as follows. Does anybody here know why we eat cholent on Shabbos?
Because we can.
Because it stayed warm and set it up before Shabbos, but then it still would be warm on Shabbos.
So why do you have to do that? Is it because it's good?
Well, you can't cook something fresh on Shabbos.
So Eleanor basically has it right. So there's a group of Jews known as the Karoyim. In Hebrew, the Karaites, as they're referred to as in English. And there have been various different types of these people throughout the years who basically believe of the premise that the written law is true and valid and divine, but the oral law is another story. The rabbis made it up. There's no such thing. So they observe their lives based on the Chumash, based on what we have in front of us, and anything that we get from the oral law, they don't accept. Well, we get a lot of things from the oral law. In fact, we get just about everything from the oral law, because the written law on its own really wouldn't suffice to create a manageable system. There's not enough information given to know what to do. The Torah talks about tzitzis, but it doesn't tell us how to make tzitzis. It doesn't tell us enough stuff about it. Also, almost every aspect, even though it's explicitly mentioned in the Torah, all the details come from the oral law. Well, the Karaite, the Karayim, didn't hold it. Now, there was a period, right now, historically, if I believe from my recollection of hearing of Beryl Wine and his history tapes, he claims that there's still a couple of pockets of them in Israel today, a few hundred in number, of people who live such a lifestyle. But there was a time in our history, in the times of the Temple, where they were a major force to be reckoned with. The biggest threat to traditional rabbinic Judaism was from this group. You know, throughout our history, there's always been a different group, which has been, sometimes it's been the Reform, it's been the Karaim, it's been non-Jews, but there's always, there was a time where the biggest threat to Torah Judaism was this group of Karaim. Well, how do you think the Karaim kept Shabbos? Well, they look through the Chumash, and it says about 35 times, keep my Shabbos and don't violate my Shabbos, but it only says one detail about how to keep Shabbos. And that is,
don't kindle any fire.
Do not have a fire in any of your homes. Well, they didn't have an oral law. Forget about not having an oral law to derive the other 38 prohibited activities. They didn't even have the oral law to define the nature of this law. We all experience and know that there's no problem with having a candle lit before Shabbos that continues to burn through Shabbos. How do you know that that's okay? Torah says you shouldn't have any candle, any fire burning on Shabbos. So we say, no, it means don't, as our article translates it, don't first kindle a fire on Shabbos. You know how to strike a match, you know how to create a fire. There is no problem to have a fire burning from before. That's what we hold, and that's why we light our Shabbos candles right before Shabbos, and they continue burning. You could leave a stove on over Shabbos, you can leave your... There's not a burner, you don't want to do that, it's not a problem. The Karoyim didn't learn like that. It says not to have any fire, b'chol moshvoseichem, in all of your dwellings. And so they therefore would not have any fire, would sit in the dark. When Shabbos started, all the candles would be extinguished, there'd be no fire, and there'd be no light. That's where they would live on Shabbos, and somehow they thought that they were having a spiritual experience sitting in the dark over Shabbos, whether or not it was cold, whatever. Now obviously, if you have no fire, you're not going to have hot food either. What developed over in the history of the Jewish people hundreds and hundreds of years ago is, again, when this was the major threat, one of the points that would distinguish you, whether or not you were in the camp of the Karaim, or whether or not you were in the camp of traditional Torah Judaism, would be whether or not you would be allowed to leave a fire on over Shabbos. That was lit from before Shabbos and would continue to burn throughout Shabbos. So the distinguishing thing that developed was, you must if you do not eat hot food on Shabbos, if I went to your house for lunch on Shabbos and everything was cold, you would be suspicious of being from the Karaim, because you don't need light in the house because it's light outside, so the fact there's no candles burning is normal. Where's the hot food? Well, there's no hot food. Maybe it's because you don't believe in being allowed to have a candle, and you would now be suspect in the Jewish community of being one of the Karaim. So what came about was, the Jewish people established, if you are with us and you believe in oral law and rabbinic Torah Judaism, you believe that you can have a fire on from before that continued to burn, and you will have hot food on Shabbos. Well, how do you have hot food on Shabbos? You can't cook on Shabbos. The only way to have hot food is to create a dish that you can have burning from before Shabbos, that you can leave on the fire all night, and then you can eat it Shabbos day and have hot food. And your hot food was a testimony to your belief in authentic oral law of Torah Judaism that says, even though the Torah says, lo sevaru eish b'chol mosh voseichem, do not light a fire, and this is the only law out of all of Shabbos, the only one that's explicitly mentioned in the Torah, and you're having hot food, says, I believe in the oral law rabbinic tradition that says that one single individual detail only means that I can't light a fire on Shabbos, but it doesn't mean I can't use a fire from before Shabbos. And when I would serve my hot food, my chamin, my cholent, which it later developed into, on Shabbos day, I am testifying to my belief in authentic rabbinic oral law Torah Judaism that allows me to have hot food. And there was a time in our history where if you did not have a cholent on your table on Shabbos, it wasn't always cholent, cholent's more of an Eastern European, some form of a chamin, some form of a hot food on Shabbos, you were suspect in the community of being from the Karaim. Now today, if you come to my house and there's no cholent, it just means that we don't like cholent. That's not the battle that we as a Jewish people are fighting anymore. That this is, it's like, who's ever heard of a Karaim before? But there was a time, and that's why people will still today make a big deal. People who like make a big deal about cholent, like rabbinic figures or religious figures, it's not just because they really like it, it's because if you look in the literature, in Jewish law, it's discussed vehemently, passionately, about having something hot to serve on Shabbos to show that this verse doesn't mean you can't have any use of fire on Shabbos. It just means that you can't light a fire on Shabbos. And there were significant groups of people who disputed that, so we have cholent on Shabbos because of that. And that's, you should have that in mind as you serve your cholent on Shabbos. Yeah.
I notice in here it says you shall not kindle fire in any of your dwellings.
Yeah.
I would think the people would have said, well, we can't do it in our dwellings, but we can have a fire, you know, somewhere else. Nearby.
I think they actually, if I remember, there's some hint about not leaving. I don't know if they left their houses either. There's something about Hotzah, about walking out of your house and not leaving your boundaries. There might be one other remez, one other hint of another, of like not walking out. You should know, these groups of people, they later developed into what's called the Tzdukim, was a similar group that also believed only in the written law, not in the oral law. And they were very prominent during the times of the Second Temple, the Tzdukim. Similar, same mindset of the Karaim. And the Gemara actually uses them in a number of instances, for halachic purposes. There are certain laws which it has to be based on, I think we discussed here once, the Zakin Mamre, somebody who fights with the Sanhedrin and disputes their ruling, and even though they ruled against him, he continues teaching his own particular opinion, even though they ruled against him. So there's a certain punishment for the Zakin Mamre, but he's only punished if the type of law that he continues to teach is an oral law type of tradition. It has to be where it's rooted in the Torah, but its details are based on the oral law. So the Gemara says, how do you know which kind of law is based on the oral law or not? The Gemara says, go ask the Tzdukim. If the Tzdukim hold of this law, then you know that it's explicit and everybody needs to know it, and it's not based on the oral law at all. But if they don't hold of it, then you know that it's based on the oral law, and we will actually use that as a litmus test to, in halachic purposes, to determine, you know, where we draw the line between that which is rooted only in the written law versus the oral law based on what they do. But they were affected. They learned this pasuk, well, sevar u'esh b'chol moshvo seichem, to mean no use of fire at all, and so that's why we have cholent. It's an important thing to keep in mind, and you should feel it when you put that cholent on the table, that you're testifying to your belief in authentic Torah Judaism. And with that, I wish you all a warm, hot Shabbos.